thank God there's a Dr. Future show coming up, because you deserve quality radio. Dr. Future, Mrs. Future, the Futurettes, cast of thousands. I think they're in the studio already.
We are here.
You sound
here,
like the you sound like the Munchkins there for a second.
I know, they've got a strange gas in the atmosphere here.
Really? Oxygen? We're not used to that?
I hope so. I hope so. It's oxygen. I love oxygen.
Just suck it up, babe. You know, if you actually have, like, real oxygen, I don't mean just, like, you know, in the atmosphere, there's, like, 13% oxygen. We're breathing largely carbon dioxide. Yes. No, we're not breathing carbon monoxide or we all be dead. That's true. So we're dripping carbon dioxide. If we actually have pure oxygen, you get into an oxygen high.
So I understand the oxygen bars are very popular for that.
Exactly. That's why John Denver used to sing Rocky Mountain High. That's what he was referring to before he crashed his plane.
Well, wait a minute. I thought they have less oxygen the higher you go in the atmosphere.
Yeah, I think that he had somehow figured out how to have more. He always seemed like he had a lot more oxygen than the rest of us.
Yeah. I understand he died near here, too, like in Monterey, over Monterey.
He crashed his plane. It was not happy times.
No.
So what's going on in the Dr. Future show today?
Well, we have a special guest the second hour. We're all about how all these crazy inventions get funded. We have a venture capitalist coming into the studio. It's going to educate us about how big money is made in Silicon Valley and how it's spent, and some new paradigms that are coming in that make it so that more companies will be funded more quickly.
I love paradigms, especially ones with coconut toppings.
Yeah, well, you'll like this then.
Thank you.
We're also talking about the new beaming rockets into space program. Instead of using just rocket fuel, we have new ways of sending rockets up with laser beams and microwaves and new small satellites that utilize Android phones.
You got the UC Santa Cruz student on who did that?
The UC Santa Cruz? No, we don't.
There's a UC Santa Cruz student who did a wonderful study about taking Android phones up into the atmosphere using high-pressure balloons and using the satellites.
Well, this actually goes into space. These are Android space devices. They turn out to be powerful little computers that can run a whole satellite.
Yeah, no, they do. And this kid did a great job, and I invited him to come on. He says, but I'm on break now.
Yeah.
And I say, you're obviously a student, and you're obviously a science major, because anybody in the business section would be on the radio as soon as they could. He's like, oh, I'm on break. Oh, I'm busy. I'm relaxing.
Yeah.
I can't come on the radio to talk about science and stuff. It's break time.
Yeah, right. He values his time off.
I need to go to Taco Bell and eat the 35% beefy burrito.
Yeah, that's the students for you, man.
That's it.
We're dealing with some new evidence that shows that meditation actually changes brain structure in about 8 weeks.
So is a hammer, by the way.
Less than 8 weeks. We're talking in the opposite direction.
Okay. Well,
I thought, making it better.
I just kind of throw that in there.
The new studies come out that shows that we can go at 100% renewable energy by 2030.
By the way, the reason I bring up the ball peen hammer thing, I got to say this, because tonight on the replay of Alex Jones' show, believe it or not, they say this, if they got rid of all guns, they could attack people with ball peen hammers. That's where I got that metaphor from. I listened to all the other talk shows here, and I was saying, oh, my God, hammers don't kill people. It's people with hammers.
Yeah, hammers and crowbars.
Or people who get hammered with hammers.
Yeah. And everyone's got a hammer, right? We all have that.
If I had a hammer.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you on that bad note. It's your show here. It can only get better.
Yeah, thank you.
Time now for What's Left. And Dr. Future.
Of that breakfast drink, Tang. Minerals, antioxidants, enzymes.
Flower power drink.
Let me share with you a new tasty treat idea.
Oh, nada.
Take one. That's right.
Oh, nada. There you go. What happened in there?
Chaos. It was chaos in here.
Oh, you were giving us a preview of the future.
Yes, I was.
Of the commercials. I see.
Welcome to the Dr. Future Show. You've heard the future is here and now. We were playing those commercials a little early for you.
Just so exciting to be here, you guys. See, Nana's really refreshed, too. She just came back from, was it 4 days of skiing with your family?
That's right. 4 days of skiing with that high mountain air. Yeah. It made me think of John Denver.
That oxygen.
Yeah, I got a little too high there. Still affecting me. I'm supposed to be quicker, though.
You're supposed to really be fast on your feet. How was the snow up in the Sierras?
We need some more snow.
Really?
See, beach weather for us in Santa Cruz means more ice in the Sierras, as we all know, if you're ski fans or snow fans. Tahoe.
It gets kind of corny, I guess.
It gets corny.
Crunchy.
Get the curly. Get the meringue.
Oh, no.
That's really nice.
Well, anyway, we're back. We got lots of good news for you today. going to start with some local news.
Yeah, big local news.
Let's give our listeners the option of surfing along with us.
Yeah, you want to do that, Mrs. Future? Tell them what they get. Okay. By doing this.
Well, what you get, I'm not sure I really understand what you're offering there, Dr. Future, but if you have your computer tuned into KSCO.com right now, listening to the Dr. Future show, then you can go to our Sinocast link by just making sure you're at KSCO.com/Dr. Future. We will surf around the web and you can just ride along with us.
Now, to make that more clear, basically, you surf to this page, and we'll just swap out the contents. You'll just can sit there, and we'll show you all the stuff we're talking about.
You get a live screen on our point of view.
So right now, if you do this, you get to see a rocket.
Yeah. But let's change it to the desalinization plant.
Ooh, like magic.
Yeah, let's start with something local.
Okay. So for everybody in the Monterey Bay area, I'm sure you've been listening over the years as we've been figuring out what to do about our water shortage.
Yeah.
This year, of course, is not a problem, but many years we're on the brink of drought and pulling our hair out and saying, what can we do to have more water when we need it?
So Monterey County has had one way of solving this challenge of water usage and a water supply by creating a plan for building a desalinization plant.
Mm-hmm.
So hence we'll be taking ocean water, desalinizing it, that is taking the salt out of it.
Yeah, and selling it to the locals.
And then selling it to the locals, that's right.
And then the water itself will become useful for plants and drinking and all that good stuff.
And what about the amount of salt that they have to extract from the water? Where's all that salt go?
When we had the environmental professors from UC Santa Cruz talking at Design Renaissance last year, they said that all that salt will itself become an environmental hazard.
That's right. What do you do with the salt?
Yes, well, I suppose that's in the typical way of this era of planning. People figure that we'll just solve one problem, and then when we have a new problem, we'll solve that problem later.
Well, isn't that the beauty of technology?
That's right. You can always keep inventing new problems and then new solutions.
That's right. I'm not really behind this desalinization plant.
Why not? John, it seems like great. We get a lot of salt water and hardly any fresh water comparatively. And now we have this great technology to convert salt water into fresh water.
But it's interesting because we do have enough water.
Yes,
yeah?
We do.
There is. We're in a tropical water zone. We have
a rainforest?
50 inches a year on average up in Ben Lomond Hills in the Santa Cruz Mountains. I mean, sometimes we've gotten 100 inches in one season.
And really, the issue is that in the heavy years, all that water flows down to the ocean, and it's not there when we need it in the light years. And so the Harrisons, Newton and Helen Meyer Harrison, presented the Santa Cruz community with some amazing ecological insights that work in Sri Lanka that was created by Buddhists several hundred years ago.
Actually, several thousand. It was Roman water engineering using Buddhist practices. So it was a Roman-Buddhist hybrid of waterway systems that are able to capture the overflow when it's the lean years, be able to recharge the water system.
So you're saying we don't need the desalinization plant. We can actually get all the water we want by sequestering water in the redwoods.
That's the word, sequestering water with trees and with
sequoias.
With sequoias.
Because they can sequester huge amounts of water.
That's right. That's right.
And also by increasing the line of the watershed. So basically by slowing water down and allowing it to create wider, marshier paths, the biodiversity that's created when you do that sequesters more water and puts more water into the entire water cycle.
That's right. The watershed.
Yeah.
So for them, when they looked at the Santa Cruz Mountains, what they're looking at is what is the health of the aquifer? Looking at solving this challenge through the health of the aquifer.
But do you know how long it's taken to get the Monterey County Board of Supervisors to unanimously approve a $300 million project with final environmental impact green lighted? You know how long it's taken to do that?
I couldn't imagine.
Yeah, but the fact that it took a long time doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best idea. In fact, it may just be a bunch of people saying, yeah, we want $350 million. Yeah, give it to us. You bet.
Yeah,
we'll worry about how to deal with the problems later.
What do you say, KSCO audience land? Do you agree with this desalinization plant? Do you think this is a good idea? Give us a call here at 479-1080. We want to hear your thoughts on it. We've made ours pretty clear. I'm not up for it.
Monterey County staff estimates that the project will create 13,100 acre-feet of potable water. Now, 1 acre foot will cover 1 acre to a depth of 1 foot, which is a little more than 36,000 gallons.
And one tree can do that.
Yeah.
One mature redwood tree can
save
the same amount.
How much diesel fuel will they use to create that water? And
cost estimates.
How are we going to pay for all that diesel as the diesel fuel prices go up?
Well, cost estimates for desalinated water range from about $3,800 to $4,800 per acre foot. But most estimates are hovering around $4,000 per acre foot. Okay. Now, residential rates in California average $905 per acre foot.
Mm-hmm. So it's currently 4 times the price of our current water.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're going to have to constantly pump salt water from the ocean, filter that salt water to freshen it in some way, and deal with disposing of the salt.
Tons of salt.
But keep in mind, there are areas in the peninsula here where families have not had potable water for 5 years. So it's answering a need that the current systems are not providing at all.
Well, for $3,000 per acre foot, couldn't those families just go drive to Florida and fill up their water jugs?
Mm. Florida?
I'm just giving you a perspective, you know. If you're going to do something with the gas, why don't you take a trip on the way, you know?
Hey, we got Clifford, who's from Salinas, would like to talk with us. Welcome, Clifford.
Hey, I don't know. That's taking the salt out of the water. Mm-hmm. What the machine does, it does not take the salt out. It takes out fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. The water that's left behind is called brackish. It's dumped back in the ocean.
And how is dumping that back into the ocean going to affect the sea creatures that are very sensitive to the saline? Anybody care about those things? I mean, we have this incredible biodiversity here.
I would assume that would be part of the environmental impact study that was just completed.
Yeah, I don't think so.
It has no effect whatsoever on anything. The plants, the animals, no effect whatsoever.
You sound very informed about this, caller. Could you please let us know?
This is Clifford.
Clifford?
Yes.
I'd just love to know what you have studied to help us be more informed.
I was trained water purification specialist by the federal government.
Were you involved with this project at all?
No, not this one here, but I know of it.
Okay, you're in favor of it then.
What it does is, like here, let's say it brings in 100 gallons.
Yeah.
It will keep maybe 30 gallons that it lets pass through the membrane and turns it into fresh water. The other water is called brackish water, and it's dumped back in the ocean, and the amount of salt that it puts back in there has no effect.
Yeah, it's a minimal
impact. It's like putting one grain of salt in 1 million gallons of water. It has no effect whatsoever.
Well, I appreciate the urgency and the ability to deal with the current situation by creating this desalinization solution, but I still feel that it's not a ecological solution because we're not doing it the way nature would do it, and we're inserting a machine that we're going to have to keep running with diesel fuel.
Well, that is correct. It's very expensive to make 1 gallon of water as to get it out of a dam or a lake or a well.
Is it 4 or 5 times the cost of...
No, I believe it's a lot more than that.
Really?
Hmm. Yes.
Hmm. Yes. Well,
so that's the downside of it.
That is the downside, in my opinion. But like I said, as far as doing that, it does have no effect on the environment, none whatsoever.
Thank you for straightening us out on that. That is a good perspective to have. We're not harming the environment. We're just spending our money on gasoline to get water.
Yes, correct.
Thanks a lot, Clifford.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I have to say that I don't think there's been enough studies done on it. I really don't. I think that we're just getting to know the animals in the Monterey Bay. Isn't this supposed to be a sanctuary? It's called the Monterey Bay Sanctuary. How does a sanctuary deal with getting more salt in there?
Well, I guess you really have to look at how much of that salt is being dumped into the ocean.
All of it's being dumped into the ocean. That's what they're doing.
And where also.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm sure that the environmental impact studies probably had something to do with that. Let's see if we can get a copy of that.
To look at that. John is calling here from Marina. Hi, John. Welcome.
Hello.
Hey, John.
How are you today?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Yes, yes. Anyway, the desal plant that's proposed there and been approved is a three-way partnership. It's one of the first public-private partnerships around. County will own the wells. The Marina Coast Water District will own and operate the desal plant, and Cal-Am will continue to supply water for their current ratepayers. The ideal nature with this plant is its vicinity. It will be placed next to the landfill where we'll use the gas from the methane extracted from the landfill, and then we have 7 Yenbacher engines there that will supply it. And the brine, which is actually, we will be taking the water from a series of wells from the Salinas River south from behind the sand dunes. This is the uniqueness. This is why the Sierra Club and the Surf Riders Foundation has got on board with our project.
Oh.
We take the already brackish intruded water, and then we treat it and remove what's called the brine, which is the salt. Then we insert it through the outfall at the PCA plant, which is next door to us, which are the two cost-prohibitive things regarding desal, which is the brine and the power.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so with the turbidity fins inside the outfall, it stirs it up all the way along the outfall pipe, and then it's pretty well mixed by the time it gets released. And the water will be actually about $2,800 to $3,200 an acre foot. It's the cheapest possible because Marina Coast Water District is doing the project. They don't have the large staff, the PERS indebtedness, and things like that.
Yeah.
The ideal nature of this is also that once we turn the wells on that series, we stop saltwater intrusion forever because we set up a pressure gradient at the interface there. And then no more water gets taken from the Carmel River, and it flows freely and becomes a habitat forever.
Yeah, so you're actually increasing the eco.
Exactly right with this. Uh-huh. Exactly. The Herald's never reported because they don't really like the Marina Coast Water District.
Oh.
Sorry to say. They don't want the project, so they fight it and do whatever they want. They think.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's really the nature of it.
Well, very interesting. Thanks for eliminating that a little bit. I appreciate it.
You know, I wonder, before you go, could you maybe give our listeners some ideas where they might be able to get more information on this? You seem very informed.
Well, sure. You could go to the MarinaCoastWaterDistrict.org site. You can go to Cal-Am's website, the Monterey County Water Resources Agency, and, of course, the Public Utilities Commission.
Okay. And how long has this been in discussion?
We had a what's called a REPOG, where we invited the entire peninsula for 3 years. We sat every month in a meeting to hash out what everybody wanted, how they wanted it, and we came up with a plan after 3 years of meetings, and then we presented it forward to the PUC with everybody on board.
Hmm. And was it a big environmental impact study that was involved with it?
Yes, there was. Yes, there was. That was the first thing completed.
Wow. Great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot for calling, John, from Marina.
Yeah. Oh, I was listening to you guys. You're good.
Good. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
And good information right there, huh?
All right.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
So, yeah, good information on the desal. Hands up, thumbs up, thumbs down. Looks like we need some more research.
Like thumbs up to me.
Well, there was a very lengthy process, so we're in good shape.
Now, another little piece of local news that came to our attention this week was that the Santa Cruz Branch rail line with purchase was finally approved.
That's a really good thing.
Yeah.
I think.
That's a 32-mile corridor with Union Pacific. And the purchase had been held up because of confusion over two different appraisals that differed by about $2 million.
So, let's see, what was it, between $12 million and $14
million? Yeah. And the California Transportation Commissioners negotiated a $400,000 price decrease from Union Pacific on Wednesday and last week. And the final purchase was approved at $14.2 million with a commitment to make $5 million in improvements.
Now, Dr. Future, tell us a little bit about this deal. How did we get here? When there's budget shrinking, crisis?
Well, it's a long-term thing. It's been going on for years and years and years.
So this isn't a part of the redevelopment.
This is the railroad that runs right along the coast all the way up to Davenport.
Right, but as we know, the redevelopment fund under our new governor, Brown, is up for debate whether the counties will be able to get this. And so how is Santa Cruz able to afford a $14 million real estate deal?
Well, they have been working towards this acquisition for the last 10 years.
Right. Wasn't it a bond or something? Didn't we vote on this?
I think it was early as 1990 that money was approved for it.
That's right. I remember voting for this, actually.
Yeah, I think it was in the Proposition 116, funding for purchase and improvements. And then Congressman Sam Farb has brought in another $1.5 million from federal. For state transportation improvement. And the Proposition 116 was approved, in 1990. So $11 million back then.
Dr. Future, do you want to know why I voted for it?
Why did you vote for it?
Because I felt like this was an opportunity for Santa Cruz County to get a little more transportation for people that don't have cars and maybe cut down on car usage. I'm a train gal, so I love the train, and we have this beautiful coastal railway.
Well, I think most people aren't looking at it as a real transportation corridor.
Why not?
I haven't really investigated that aspect of it as much, but from what I can see, it seems like a big chunk of the road goes out to Davenport, and that's not exactly where a lot of people need to go for transportation.
Well, apparently what it is it hooks up with the Union Pacific Railroad out there. So.
And it's nicer as a tourist thing or a dinner train. Go out there and watch the sunset in Davenport. You'll get more people in. Because why go to Davenport unless you're going it for fun? It's not really a destination location for anything else.
Well, it's got some of the best tide pools on the coast of California.
That's a tourist destination.
That's right.
Right? And that's what they're talking about. They're looking at it.
But it's not just going to Davenport. It's going the other way. It's going to Watsonville. How many people drive from Watsonville to Santa Cruz every day?
Well, that has possibilities. I may think that has more commercial possibilities to Watsonville.
So, dear KSCO audience, do you remember voting for this? Do you remember this bond where we were going to be taking the railway and making it a part of our county's property? Did you vote for it, yes or no? When you did, was this what you were thinking was going to happen with it? I know it's been a long time, but maybe you have a memory. Give us a call here at 479-1080. We'd love to hear from you. I was really excited about the idea. Like I said, I'm a train gal. I built some of the BART stations, some Valley Transit Authority stations.
Yeah, they're also looking at bicyclists, too. Bike trail.
And I say do them together. No reason to have one or the other.
Yeah, and they could have some interesting train.
Yeah, have one side bike, other side running. Make it a strand.
Yeah. Anyway, it looks like now that they bought it, we can start thinking about these issues more, exactly what we want on it.
So now the question is the county going to use its full advantage? We should have, we were guessing about $25 million with this.
Well, we should crowdsource some ideas, see what the audience thinks would be good for the train line along the coast.
If you've got an idea, give us a call here at 479-1080.
Yeah. The thing about the train line, preserving the rail lines, it's very much, at this point, it seems like a conservation project more than it seems like something that people can make use of, because it doesn't go all the way to Watsonville just yet. It's just the 32 miles from Davenport down to Santa Cruz.
Is it 32 miles to Davenport?
Let's see. No, I guess it's 16 miles to Davenport, but I'm just reading the article here, and here's what Ellen Puri says. Even if there are no immediate plans for service to South Santa Cruz County, it will prove beneficial down the line. And she says, for me, it's about holding the rail line for the future, and future generations will decide exactly how we use it. But I think that preserving that corridor that directly connects North and South County will prove to be one of the best moves that the RTC has ever made. So it's a long-term development
project.
It's an
open question, yeah. I mean, that's in the Register.
Pajaronian? Pajaronian.
Yeah.
Pajaro
Valley.
If you go to kco.com/Dr. Future, you will see it. So now, should we go from ground transportation to space transportation?
That's your favorite.
Now, here's the future for you. There's a new breakthrough in thinking about how to launch rockets into space. Right now, when you think of a space launch, it evokes in your mind that image that we've had for decades, that bright orange ball of flame exploding beneath a rocket as it lifts and
spewing carbon into our atmosphere and just adding to global warming. But go on, Dr. Future.
I'm looking at the emotional impact, my dear. Well, That whole thing is being rewritten with the idea of what they call beaming rockets into space.
Beaming rockets
into space.
How are you going to beam a rocket into space?
It's an alternative propulsion system proposed by several researchers, including some NASA scientists. But imagine, if you will, that instead of an explosive chemical reactions on a rocket, the new concept, dubbed beamed thermal propulsion, involves propelling a rocket by shining laser light or microwaves at it from the ground.
Huh.
So the technology would make it possible for a reusable single-stage rocket that can carry 2 to 5 times more payload than conventional rockets, and it would cut the cost of sending payloads into low Earth orbit dramatically. Now, it's still an explosion underneath it. Let me clear this up. It's not like we're just beaming it up on a microwave beam. But the microwave or the laser ignites like a liquid hydrogen payload for the fuel. Not payload, but fuel. A liquid hydrogen fuel. And rather than carrying two types of fuels on the rocket and then combining them to create the explosion, you just have one type of fuel, and that the beam, laser beam, ignites that and uses the energy of the laser beam to keep it burning. So you have a constant beam going on the rocket as it goes up into space.
That's fascinating, okay. Dr. Future. Right. We've got a phone call, though.
Okay.
And, let's see. This is Michael. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Hey, it's me.
All right.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you for calling.
You're one of our favorite callers, Michael.
I have a quick question. I heard on KSL earlier this week talk about how NASA is developing the capability to collect solar energy in space and beam it down to perhaps individual households around the world.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about that?
You think that's why those birds died?
Recent information? I will check into that immediately. I've always been fascinated with the idea of beaming energy from space to the Earth. It was first made popular in the 70s
mm-hmm.
with the L5 Society and the idea that microwaves and laser beams could be used for beaming energy directly. This story that I've just been sharing is similar to that.
Similar to that, yeah. The premise here was that they would be able to, without the interference of the Earth's atmosphere, collect much more solar energy and then focus that energy right into individual homes, the beams or whatever that you're talking about. And evidently, this whole thing is much further along than most people would imagine. And in fact, when the NASA took it to the government and said, this is what we're doing, you don't want to cut our funding for this, the federal government said, oh, you're crazy. So I was just wondering if you've heard anything along those lines. What about Googling solar energy from space?
Okay, let's see.
In the back of my mind, I went to a Future Fest conference a few years ago, and there was a display there by a NASA solar power scientist who was using solar panels in space and some kind of laser beam technology.
Well, I think that would be kind of what we're talking about then.
Yeah, well, what he described, he said at that time that the technology was very, very inefficient because even though the atmosphere cuts down on the efficiency of solar panels here on Earth, that isn't really the biggest inefficiency in solar power. I mean, when we're using solar power with current technologies, we're only getting about 15% of the potential photovoltaic energy just because of the technology. And
right.
If you put those solar panels out in space, you maybe double their capacity, but you're still only getting like 30% of direct sunshine.
I think this is
and
what you're referring to.
I think you lose some of that when you transport that power through
sure.
some other concentrated beam.
I found an article on this in the Telegraph. Japanese scientists seek to harness solar power in space. It's all about how the Japanese scientists are looking at how to generate solar power from space using satellites, which is very similar to the solar-powered satellite concepts of the 70s. Only this is the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, Mitsubishi Electric, and Kyoto University. They and several other Japanese organizations are jointly conducting solar power generation research. So
well, that being said, I know how to get spaceships up there without any CO2 being messed around with.
Really?
What's your secret?
Yeah.
Slingshot.
A big slingshot. Right. I think so. Maybe a trampoline.
That works. Bye-bye.
Yeah,
thanks
I've,
for the
I've
call.
Heard.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for the call, Michael.
I've heard of rail guns, too, Michael. Yes, the slingshot idea, the rail guns, these all use electromagnetics for moving an object really rapidly like a gun, only using electromagnetics to a speed and getting it into orbit. Not too safe for living organisms because you start to hit like 12 Gs, things like that, that are not very friendly to biological life forms. But it's really good for tech.
I just found an article, Dr. Future, where it's Indian and U.S. experts team on space solar power.
Oh, yeah? You mean solar-powered satellites?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The thing is, if you collect the power in space, it just doesn't make any sense that that would be more efficient than collecting it on Earth where
sure,
you want to use
it.
No, because power, most of the power is lost in the transmission. Most of it is lost moving it around, not collecting it.
Well, they've gotten much more efficient with the microwave transmissions of power. And laser as well. NASA has been looking at using laser-powered airplanes of late.
So this was an Aviation Week, a McGraw-Hill publication.
Oh, yeah?
The Space Solar Power, SSP, has been obviously going on for a long time, like you were mentioning from the 70s.
Oh, yeah. Toronto Neal's L5 Society.
Yeah, it seems to be catching some wave. Barack Obama's presidency, this was part of their summit with the Indian. This was back in December. So
the idea is that you have 24/7 solar up there, and you can transmit it back to Earth. The only problem is that you have these microwave laser zones where you can, if you go, it can be very hazardous to your health.
So they're saying that there's this 10-10-10 rule for a first prototype in geostationary orbit that could be a goal for this new bilateral initiative between India and the U.S. And the system would deliver 10 megawatts of power, cost less than $10 billion to build and launch, and be ready in less than 10 years.
Oh, so they're talking a 10-year time frame for
yeah.
this.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
a,
yeah.
Wow, interesting.
The system would consist of a large satellite to collect the sun's energy and convert it into microwaves, which would be beamed to an antenna on Earth that would collect the microwaves for conversion to electricity and transmit them through existing power grids.
Yeah, that's the wireless transmission of power, something originally espoused by Nikola Tesla over 100 years ago.
My favorite.
That's $1 billion per... What was it, the megawatts?
Well, it's 10 megawatts of power, and then it would cost $10 billion to build and launch. So it would be in after that, it would then be able to just collect the energy free.
Well, so after the initial cost, it just keeps doing its thing,
just
and off we
it.
Go. All right, cool. Hey, that reminds me, we do have another story that has to do with sustainable energy. But we'll do that in a few minutes after the break.
More yeah. sustainable
yeah.
energy,
well,
Dr. Future?
Yeah, there's some good news that we can be 100% renewable energy by 2030.
Oh, and we also have a caller, Logan. Please hang on. We'll get to you.
All right. See you shortly.
Enjoy.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're just talking about renewable energy. There's a new study that just came out that claims that we can have 100%, not 90, 100% renewable energy by 2030. And what do we have to do to get that, you might ask?
Yeah.
Well, to achieve 100% renewable energy would mean the building of about 4 million 5 megawatt wind turbines. 4 million wind turbines.
I'm amazed that you're saying this, Dr. Future.
Or 1.7 billion 3-kilowatt solar photovoltaic systems.
Because I was just up at Kirkwood where they're having some pretty hard electrical problems. They had their power station burned down and they're just paying up the yin-yang for their electricity.
Yeah.
And there was so much wind
yeah.
blowing at the top. And I kept thinking, boy, they just had one wind turbine generator. Good golly.
It would help a lot.
Yeah. Could yeah. at least run one of those lifts, huh?
Yeah. Well, still, our fossil fuel load is 80%. Right now, 80% of the world's energy supply is still coming from fossil fuels. I thought it was more than that, but according to this study, we're down 80%. It looks to me like the big ones are solar power and wind. You know, as the alternatives.
Wind and tide harnessing and, the tide power.
Yeah. I think the Scots are very advanced in that department. They have underwater wind turbines.
Yeah.
No, they move with the tide, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty neat. So for this kind of vision to happen, there need to be a lot of building to happen. The wind turbines, would need to have 2 to 3 times the capacity of today's wind turbines to really make them more efficient.
And there's those jobs we need.
Yeah, though a lot of people are also leaning towards the new nuclear option.
Mm.
You know, the pebble nuclear reactors from China.
No, the pebble
reactors. Yeah, they're supposed to be really efficient, very little waste, really clean, no CO2 emissions. Ultimately, the universe runs on fusion, so we should too. The question is whether or not this is a stopgap measure until we figure out fusion. All of this really is. I mean, once we figure out fusion, it's the end game for all of this stuff. But meanwhile, wind and solar look pretty good. The pebble reactors, a lot of debate is going on whether or not they're really the way to go. To me, it looks like we can avoid any potential problem with nuclear reactors with these other alternatives. Bucky Fuller once said, what's the safest distance for a nuclear reactor from us?
I know the answer.
Yeah, what's that, Agent Sun?
96 million miles or?
Yeah, you're in the ballpark. 93 million miles. The distance between us and the sun.
That's a big nuclear reactor there.
That's right. Got us this far.
So basically, for us to get off of fossil fuels, though, it would take an Apollo-type effort, you know, moon landing-type effort for us to really push it. We'd really have to have that initiative. Unfortunately, I don't see us having that right now. So.
Well, the big thing about solar is that it can be a distributed initiative, because if we could just get a lot of people getting some degree of self-sufficiency with their own solar setup, then a lot of the industrial use of fossil fuels would be alleviated.
Yeah, true. And there are many other alternatives that we're starting to explore. Our World Tesla Society organization is investigating the zero-point energy machines and stuff like that. And sooner or later, we may have a breakthrough in that department that could shift everything, too. So.
And that World Tesla Society is opened up to Santa Cruzians all across the county.
That's right.
And Monterey.
We have a number of bad scientists in the woods that come down for our meetings. And share with us their latest inventions.
Did you say bad or mad?
It sounded bad, but that's just the allergies talking.
Bad, glad, mad combination.
Yeah.
These are rad scientists.
Rad scientists, right. They're cool. We had a lot of interesting people in the woods. We have a guy that actually invented the first hybrid synergy drive for Toyota, the Prius. He's from Santa Cruz.
So when's your next meeting?
Well, we're planning it. Tom Quinn is our co-conspirator on that front, and we're planning it probably next month.
Now, Tom Quinn is also
a host
here at KSCO.
That's right.
He's on the weekends after the Saturday special.
Yeah, he's busy working hard. He's logging the trenches, having to make what he calls Yankee dollars to pay the bills.
Yankee dollars.
As soon as he finishes his latest projects, he'll be able to join us on the edge once again. So stay tuned. We'll probably have a Tesla Society in the middle of February. I'll keep you posted on that. The other thing I was mentioning is that the laser microwave technologies will allow us to send rockets into space much more cheaply and easily, because we won't have to carry nearly as much fuel in order to send something up into space with those technologies. And to make it even easier, there are a number of satellite systems now that are utilizing the sophistication of our mobile computing devices, like the Android phone, for example, so that we can basically run very small microsatellites with our small phone technology. If you check our links, we have our smartphone-powered satellite article up now at ksco.com/Dr. Future.
Boy, these phones just get smarter and smarter, don't they? They're just all over the place.
That's right. These small ones are actually being developed in England. One's called the Strand 1 nanosatellite. It's 11.8 inches in length, and it will take pictures of the Earth. It has control electronics all running on Android. Pretty amazing. So the economics of this are fascinating, because it starts to give satellite capability to just about anyone who can afford low-cost mobile satellite production.
I had no idea.
Company.
I could do that.
All the things you can do with your mobile phone. Who would have thought you could hurl it into space and have your own satellite?
Yeah.
I thought the satellites were supposed to send the signal to your phone.
Yeah. Well, last year, NASA Ames here in the Bay Area sent a couple of HTC Nexus 1s 30,000 feet into the atmosphere. Each phone has a payload in a small rocket. It was moderately successful. One phone bit the dust after the rocket parachute failed, but the other one walked away unscathed. It captured more than 2.5 hours of video on its little 720 by 480 pixel camera.
And what did it tell us?
It was a proof of concept. It shows you that you could do really super low-cost experiments high in the atmosphere with cameras, GPS navigation. For example, everyone wonders about these strange contrails in the sky. Some of them call them chemtrails. This kind of technology would allow more people to investigate that. Instead of just complaining about them, you'd be able to maybe analyze them and see if there really was any strange material in those chemtrails. You know what I mean? It makes us less of a victim of circumstance.
Or conspiracy theory.
Or conspiracy theory. Hey, no, it's real.
Dr. Future, we got Carl on from Wisconsin. Welcome, Carl.
Hi, Carl.
Hey there, Carl.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Hello. Hello. Hey. How's it going out there in Cowland?
It's very nice and cold here in Wisconsin.
I bet it is.
It's the winter.
So any particular thing we triggered you off today on this satellite?
Well, sure. Yeah. There's some really good topics I wanted to share. You were talking about alternative energy.
Yeah.
And I heard a lot of high-tech solutions being mentioned, but I haven't heard anything about low-tech solutions.
Well, I consider Android to be relatively cheap low-tech. I guess it's high-tech. Maybe you think
everything's like microwave this or laser that or solar this or solar that. You know, it is easier for us to chill our beer by just throwing our beer outside than it is to actually pay to have it refrigerated.
Is that what you do? In Wisconsin, I guess it's easier, right?
Yeah, it's very easy to cool and take care of things. And so, you know, you could save energy costs. That's just one low-tech solution. But I'm thinking design. I'm thinking energy savings by design because it occurs to me that most of the problems with energy use is energy waste. And the efficiency of how we use energy is just abysmal. That's what I sort of see.
So really pay attention to what's around us and maybe utilize what is more effectively, like the cold of the winter that we're surrounded by. Or the warmth, if you're in a warm country.
Well, there's a thing they do here that they used to do to keep things cold. They used to bury two pipes in the ground, and the ground has a constant temperature, so that kept a base temperature from keeping things cold. So in the winter, it kept you warmer, and summer, it kept things cooler.
Yeah, good point, Carl.
Yeah, there's some low-tech ways of saving. Here in California, it's a little harder because it's warmer. You have to dig down.
The same thing works. If you go down deep enough, though, everything has a base temperature as soon as you go down far enough under the ground. And other thing that I was thinking about is just the design of our cities and how we get around. I mean, clearly transportation takes up a lot of energy to just go to and fro.
Yeah, root cellars. Those have gone back a long time. Humanity's figured out how to use that.
That's true. I guess a lot of humanity's figured out these things in previous
generations. A long time ago.
And we're here we are trying to figure out these new high-tech solutions when we don't have to.
Yeah, instead of making things more complicated, we may find that there's new insights if we just look back to nature.
Yeah,
nature is always a great teacher.
Like the desalinization plant proposal?
Well, how about just slowing down, too? I mean, one of the things is that what drives energy use is by the pace by which we choose to live our lives. I mean,
get off the hamster wheel?
Yeah, for instance, going to California from Wisconsin, you could have two options, really. You could fly and take you about 5 hours, or you could take a train, which could take something like 3 days. Mm-hmm. You have all these other options, but most of the time people are going to fly, which takes an enormous amount of energy.
You've inspired me, Carl. Maybe we should change the name of the human race to the human vacation.
No, not so much, but cause I think no matter what, work is still going to be work, and you're still going to have to get things accomplished. But clearly, I think part of the big energy crisis is with this hyper-consumption rate.
Yeah.
That we're just trying to consume and get this and get that. And there's just so many simple ways, I think, to effectively change the way we use energy. Remember the milkman?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, the milkman is a good solution in a broader sense because instead of us all going to the store, why not employ somebody to bring the store to us in some aspect?
That's right.
Well, there were experiments on the web of grocery stores that you could order stuff and they deliver it. Amazon delivers a lot of grocery products now. You can set up regular deliveries every month get your toilet paper that way.
I think that's a part of the paradigm shift. And I want to thank Carl for reminding us of it. There's a lot of ways that we could be saving energy. There's a lot of reasons why we're this hyper-consumer nation, and then we're also a disposable-oriented nation. And recycling and all of these reuses, upcycling of all the material that we go through.
Right on, right on. I think that's really important, actually. That's very key. The reason it hasn't worked for us economically, for two reasons. We haven't decided as a culture to subsidize it to get it going.
Yeah.
That's one. And two, it has to happen on a large enough scale for it to have a payback. So clearly, if you do it onesie, twosie for the people that are talking about online delivery and stuff, which has been the failure of that, but if it was done on a large enough scale, it works very well.
Yeah, yeah. I always used to imagine that we'd have pneumatic tubes going all to our houses by now, that we'd be able to order things and then have them delivered by tube.
Oh.
But, you know, that was a 50s pipe dream.
One other thing I want to share, though, is something that I heard was called locally grown, locally manufactured. The idea of local economies and
yes.
local produce.
That's very popular here.
That idea of shipping, like, we get our milk from Oregon in Wisconsin. I mean, but we're a large dairy state. We're a large dairy state.
Exactly.
The irony of it is why are we getting our milk from across the country? And the thing is, if we were to start doing things locally and supporting each other on a local level, we would be empowering all kinds of small business and relationships.
Very good point, and
thanks
we truly support you on that. We have
Absolutely.
Many efforts along those lines in town here. Well, thank you, Carl, for
Future
checking in.
Future is local, here now.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
So we've got second hour coming up.
We're going to deal a little more deeply into the world of venture capital and how to finance all these strange projects.
It's a beautiful thing to advertise with Dr. Future. It makes you feel so good. You'll be so happy.
For a little extra, Agent Nada will read your text.
I will speak for you. I will say it with sexy Slavic accent.
Make your ordinary message extraordinary.
Advertise with Dr. Future.
DrFutureShow.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show.
Yeah, it's going to be a great second hour.
Yeah, so I was wondering if we can hear from our guest.
Deli, do you hear us?
I sure do.
Oh, good. Okay.
We hear you too. Connection.
Ali is a teacher in entrepreneurship, venture capital, and strategy at Monterey Institute of International Studies, which is the Graduate School of Middlebury College, located out here in Monterey. He also teaches at Stanford in the scenario and uncertainty topics at the Stanford University School of Engineering. And he's currently a general partner at the Concepto Ventures, London, Madrid branches, and Euro Demand, another venture company dealing with some very interesting ventures in Europe. We brought Ellie on because the whole world of venture capital is one of the engines that's driving the new technology of today. And really, Silicon Valley is the crown jewel in our economy and is really moving us all into a new world. And so I thought we'd give you a little bit of education on how venture capital works and how the monies flow. And Ellie's the perfect guy for making it understandable for us.
Ellie so, Zelkon.
Yes, Ellie Zelka.
Welcome.
Now, welcome, Ellie.
Thanks a lot, Alan. As usual, it's great to be listening to you and sharing ideas with you.
Yeah, thank you. Now, could you give us a little bit about how you got into this world yourself? You originally came from Iran, is that right?
That's true. I was born and raised in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
My family's Iraqi, and we traveled some. We went to Israel, a bit in Europe, and I came to the U.S. for my education. Then went back to Afghanistan and did a company for 7 or 8 years. And then following the Soviet invasion, I actually moved to California, went to Stanford for a couple years, the school. And since then, I've been really in the technology sector, primarily as vice president of strategy or new ventures for a while with some of the computer companies. Really, I worked with UB, with Tandem Computer and Compaq. And then I had a venture fund, Palo Alto Ventures, which did the venture investing on behalf of Philips Electronics, the Dutch electronics company.
Now, can you give us a little bit idea of, you know, say, if you have a great idea today and you want to create a company around it, what's involved with that? Is that a very complicated process at this point?
Frankly, it's really a tremendously fascinating and gratifying process. Uh-huh. Watching and listening and dealing with lots of folks that are doing exactly what you're describing, mm-hmm. and seeing some of them have remarkable success, because it's really possible these days. I guess it's always been possible, but I think more so now, to start ventures with relatively limited sums and scale them globally to really being, you know, really significant companies with tremendous value and the potential ability to gain liquidity, to sell them as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Google started that way, right? So Google was a VC company.
Google did gain some venture capital. It's, you know, it started without it with some angel investors and went on to get some venture capital. And certainly they have tremendous scale.
Yeah.
But I think it's also important to realize some fairly long odds, certainly, to have anything like the kind of success you're speaking of there.
Yeah, well, yeah, really. But what's more the typical trajectory of a company that gets venture capital today? What, how does it start with a small team of dedicated individuals who want to make this product real and then scale up from there? What? And how long does it usually take?
That's really true. It's basically, typically, it really starts with one person or one or two, a couple people working together. Oftentimes the source is really an idea, an idea to really build something of substantial meaning. Oftentimes you see ventures that we've worked with, let's say, spend the first 3 months or so, 6 months, essentially just working themselves and doing it out of pocket, or friends or family. And sometimes you see them succeed in moving on to where it's necessary, to working with, let's say, angel investors. Mm-hmm. But it's really essential to be clear. Many ventures don't require outside funding, and ideally everyone should avoid outside funding.
Because you want to hold on to as much of the company yourself as possible, if it's your baby.
That's true, for control reasons, for many reasons. But there are businesses that really require substantial investment to be done. And for those, of course, venture capital is appropriate. But frankly, venture capital itself over the years has really moved way upstream into focusing on larger and larger deals, and frankly becoming also more risk averse than, let's say, it was in earlier periods.
You mean more like the banks now? It's
well, really before the dot-com crash, right?
Following that really has led to that. You're both absolutely correct. It's many cases venture capitalists are behaving much more like private equity investors and much more risk averse.
Now, Ellie, one of the things you educated us on was that there are new trajectories, new ways in which venture monies are being dealt with today, too.
Such as the Y Combinator and accelerator models and incubators, things like that.
Can you tell us about those?
Absolutely. Just as the VCs are sort of moving away from these, I mean, a whole new breed that's come out, and you mentioned that are really taking advantage of the core developments, where today it's a lot easier to develop, let's say, an enterprise software company or a substantial consumer web-based firm with substantial scale than it ever was before. So as a result, there are both funds and incubators which are taking advantage of these new trends. You mentioned Y Combinator.
How does that work? Is it like a new type of school or a program? If you want to get funded, you join, or what? How would you describe
it? In some ways it is that way. Whereas venture capital has traditionally been, you know, an individual entrepreneur approaches a VC and it's done on a one-off basis, Y Combinator completely switched it around. They treat it more like a class. You could almost call it like summer camp, where they try to select, let's say, 20 new teams for one class.
Each one of them potentially a company. There's 20
teams. Exactly. And they get many, many, many hundreds of applications, if not thousands of applications. So given their success, they really have a great deal of demand.
And they, you said success. Then what do you mean?
Y Combinator has been phenomenal in its success in the sense that your average small entrepreneurial venture, for example, its chances of getting funding, let's say $500,000 in funding.
This is the classical model.
Under the classical model has been very, very low. I would say maybe 1 in 100, or
really?
It might even be as much as little as 1 in 1,000.
Wow.
That can gain that kind of investment.
Well, it's harder than like getting into Stanford or something.
Yes, it definitely is. Now you look at Y Combinator, these teams, oftentimes very young teams, after 3 months at Y Combinator, they're getting funding of, let's say, $500,000 through some of the emerging new super angels or angels, or in some cases, full-scale venture capitalists at a phenomenal rate, let's say 60, 70, sometimes even higher percentages.
Wow.
That is nothing but revolutionary when you think about that transformation in those changes from under 1% to, let's say, 65, 70%.
And you're saying that they're starting with a kind of an accelerated class learning environment combined with small amounts of money. Now, small amounts, you're talking $20,000, $25,000 per group, something like that?
That's right. You really hit on it, on a really central point, Alan, in that traditionally venture capital will work in fairly large numbers. Increasingly today, a classic, let's say, first round by a venture capital fund, a Series A is what they call it, you know, will be a couple million dollars. Y Combinator turns it, as I mentioned, in a summer camp-like style, and what they're giving is like $15,000, $20,000.
Wow.
Really enough for two or three young entrepreneurs really to afford a small apartment and to work hard together for 3 months. But what they make up for instead of the money is just incredible guidance and advice and relationships and guidance towards some of the emerging methodologies and approaches which enable these small companies to really skyrocket. Mm-hmm.
So they really are getting guidance every day in that intense environment.
It varies entirely, but they're working very closely with these teams. And the Y Combinator team is really a group of very well-connected people. So it's not only the advice the core team is giving them, but all the relationships which they have and all the relationships they open up.
Right. It's the social network that you're part of then.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I don't want to make this as purely a Y Combinator phenomena.
Uh-huh.
There's some activities. There's Founders Co-op in Seattle, which is a similar theme. We're moving towards a similar path with Concepto Ventures in Europe. The whole lean startup movement, which has a number of dimensions, is really very closely related to the phenomena we're seeing through Y Combinator.
So that's really what's working in this economy.
That really is. This lean startup movement. I don't know if you've discussed that movement at all on your program, Alan.
This is actually a kind of a first for us, Ellie, to have a finance person, a venture capital person such as yourself to speak to our audience, because we spend a lot of time envisioning the future, and then we try and talk to people who can help us see what are the footsteps to get from where we are to where we expect to be.
Interesting. That's fascinating. Well, the other side of it, son, is also interesting. The way some of these companies come to life and evolve and end up doing really remarkable things. Like some of the new companies you're seeing in one of the new spaces you're seeing emerge today that you might find fascinating is the whole crowdsourcing space.
Yes, that's a fascinating topic in and of itself, right? Is that what they're financing? Crowdsourcing is a popular area in which new companies are forming?
Right now it is. And actually, that's even moved to the level where traditional venture capitalists are now also funding crowdsourcing companies. And there's any number of really interesting ones. These crowdsourcing also goes under the name of distributed work.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you could define for our listeners a little bit about what crowdsourcing is.
Yeah, crowdsourcing would be a very rich topic for us to define and describe right after our break.
Yeah, we have to have a break first, but then we can get back. We'll look forward to hearing a little more from LA about what crowdsourcing is and how that's evolving.
And distributed, what was that you just said, LA?
Distributed work.
Yeah.
Distributed work, great. Right.
Stay tuned. KSCO.
Dr. Future.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Ellie Zelka, venture capitalist and professor in these topics of venture capital and entrepreneurialism. So, Ellie, you were going to tell us about crowdsourcing as an area of investment in the venture world today. Could you define that a little bit for us?
Certainly. Crowdsourcing are some of these new emerging platforms, really websites, which bring people together, people who can provide work services, let's say website building or perform a piece of music or programming or whatever, directly with clients anywhere else in the world, which really eliminates a lot of businessmen, a lot of middlemen between the individual worker and the buyer of these services. So oftentimes, so you can look at it as sort of like an eBay-like platform where instead of things being sold, people are requesting certain types of work. Let's say I need this tape transcribed or I need this software developed. And others globally from around the world will bid on doing this work and perform it.
Like the Mechanical Turk, the Amazon project?
Exactly. Mechanical Turk with Amazon is a classic example of that. But there's also some very interesting and sort of fun new platforms. Fiverr is one.
Yeah, exactly.
F-I-V-E-R-R, actually. Where
I'll put that up on our site here. Now, tell us about Fiverr, Ellie.
It's basically, what are you willing to do for $5? You know, what's your individual expertise that you can deliver something for $5?
Well, let's see what we got here. Let's see. I will make a crude 30-second video ranting and raving angrily about anything you want for $5.
That's right. But in addition to some of the funnier and more interesting, crazy ones, and God, there's a lot of those, and it's really, I find it very entertaining to check that out. There's also some very serious work that you can do through there. Huh. And at the cost of $5, like the cost of the experiment, is so low that you're really willing to be quite experimental and adventurous. I mean, after all, it's a fiver that you're risking.
Right, right. That's nothing. I will write an awesome Valentine's poem for you. I will write a love poem for your sweetie. I will take a picture of me holding a message in Times Square for you. People are really taking advantage of where they are to be able to do this, too. It looks very interesting. I will make a video of you and your product on the beaches of Uruguay and Brazil for $5. Very cool.
You know, Santa Cruz being by the ocean, it's interesting. I've seen some folks listing the service, which, frankly, I've bought a couple of his. I will write something on the sand for you for $5.
That's great.
I did that as a birthday present for a friend.
Have you tried it yourself, Ellie?
I certainly have used it. And frankly, I've used it for fun and a bunch of like cool Christmas presents, etc. But we're also using it very aggressively for work. I mean, we've created, for example, a little online video commercial by assembling like 7 or 8 different little fibers where we have one person simply getting photographs for us, another person doing some animation, a third person creating original music, believe it or not.
Wow, that's so cool.
Dollars and putting it all together. But you know, Alan, it's also important to remember Fiverr is sort of has a fun dimension, etc. Some of these platforms, for example, Odesk, are really much more fundamentally serious and people can also be compensated very, very substantially more than $5. I mean,
yeah, I would hope so.
Average deals on some of those platforms run in the thousands.
Yeah, you're starting to get into the realm of digital sweatshops, you know, with low cost. Now, what's the Odesk? How does that work?
Odesk is another platform. It's really more oriented towards people serving the needs of small business. And, you know, it's, again, the whole plethora. If you need graphic services, if you need programming services, certainly web-type services, etc., it's an interesting platform to use. You should also always think about it not only as a place to buy things, but as a place to sell your own unique resources and services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the great things about the whole crowdsourcing phenomenon is that people who have a certain amount of web literacy can get sort of a micro wage, at least by California standards, but there are opportunities to pick up $1 or $5 or small amounts of money for doing things that people have requested, and not just anything. You can also offer your own skills out there, and that will drive the requests.
That's really true.
So you can find people for your project that you want to work on. You can then work together as if you're in the same office, I guess using their software. And you pay only for time worked for the Odesk.
Yeah, in general, it's done much more on a specific assignment basis where someone contracts. Well, there's a whole bunch of different models. And there's some very fascinating ones, actually. Typically, someone is contracting to do the work. Alan, you remind me of a very fascinating one. In one case, there's one called 99design. Hmm. It's originally an Australian company that has now moved to San Francisco. And in that case, when you want some work done, mm-hmm. let's say I need a small website, mm-hmm. what they do is they set it up as a design contest.
Between lots of different groups, huh? Instead
exactly.
of a lot of designers.
And, for example, even on a small project where you're spending, let's say, a few $100s, you know, you might easily get, you know, 40, 50 different design proposals for that project from people all over the world. And, frankly, I find it just tremendously exciting and fun and interesting just looking at these proposals and choosing among them. I think it makes for an extremely intelligent buyer, frankly, to be selecting from such rich variety of options offered directly to you.
Mm.
So it's so interesting. The new economy is really about cross-matching. It's really about there being a much more open way for people to just find each other, just put themselves out and connect with somebody who might like to know who they are.
You're right. You're absolutely right. These platforms really do that, and they do it globally in such interesting ways. Another comment about crowdsourcing is they're also, these companies that we just mentioned, like Odesk or Fiverr or 99design, these themselves are new emerging companies that are emerging right now. They themselves are the product of the changes in the venture environment that we spoke about.
Are some of them from groups like Y Combinator?
These particular ones aren't directly spin-offs from Y Combinator, which tends to really focus much more on direct consumer kinds of web application companies rather than the crowdsourcing, which tends to be business-to-consumer kinds of or business-to-business kinds of environments.
Gotcha. Now, crowdsourcing is on an upward track right now. You say there will be more and more examples of this over the next couple of years that will do more and more things. Like, for example, could you source an invention? Could you take something from concept to delivery with crowdsourcing? Do you think that will be possible in the near future? Somebody else?
I think that the way that venture capital is going and the way the industry is moving, it's really increasingly, it's possible to do very small things, which traditional venture capital really doesn't have a meaningful role in that. I think there's an interesting and valid argument that's being made right now that venture capital ultimately is moving towards crowdfunding, where individuals, you and I and your listeners, will individually be deciding who gets funding and who doesn't.
You mean like Kickstarter?
Exactly. I think that's a fascinating platform for funding a film or an art piece or... And frankly, I think those kinds of platforms would be wonderful to the degree that they move towards funding companies. But in the full form, that's not possible today through a platform like Kickstarter, because frankly, it runs directly against
SEC securities
SEC rules. Regulations, which are designed to really protect consumers from in buying what's viewed as a sophisticated financial product, which certainly an investment in a startup is.
Mm-hmm. So this smaller in the sense that it could make enough money to fund a small group of people in pursuing a dream, like making a film or creating a new device or a new accessory for your iPhone or something like that.
I mean, that's really true. That's really true.
So for small entrepreneurs, it's really interesting.
It is interesting, but the problem is you can't do... I think if you're financing a film or a band, etc., I think it works quite well. Mm-hmm. But I think in terms of a traditional business, it can be tricky because you can't sell stock on Kickstarter.
Right.
Because of, as we said, because of SEC regulations. But you're seeing companies, you know, you and I were speaking over the weekend about this one little company called TikTok, which had a concept of doing watch band for the iPod Nano, which can just be together with that watch band. The iPad Nano can be a super high-tech new kind of a watch. Very cool idea.
Yeah.
And they were trying to raise $15,000 through Kickstarter, through that platform. And the way they were doing it was they were saying, if we raise $15,000, we will do this. So if you're willing to commit to, let's say, $25 or $50, depending on which model of watch band you would like, please commit to it. And again, if we reach to $15,000, we will produce it and we will ship it to you. Well, guess what? This was an example where they not only reached the $15,000 and $150,000 bid, they racked up over $1 million.
Amazing, isn't it? I've seen some really go way over the top. Other projects hardly get funded at all. It's really interesting to watch the process.
That is. What was interesting there is that they ended up effectively getting funding for their company without giving away a single percentage of equity either.
Amazing.
That's sweet.
Yeah, that's sweet. Wow.
Just by discovering customers.
Right.
Looking at this of yourself, have you seen any trends in what projects actually get funded by Kickstarter and programs like that, and as opposed to what doesn't get funded? Is there any trends that you've noticed?
I'm not really familiar enough with it to be able to tell the trends, but the sense I have is that it's really much more oriented towards artistic endeavors than pure business kinds of endeavors. That's my impression. What about you, Alan? How do you see it?
Because I've seen some projects get 10 times their funding, others that look really good projects barely get in there. It's a mystery to me. I haven't seen anything that I can say why this one would be a success over that. That's why I asked you. There's just amazing creativity coming through Kickstarter, and I think it's worthy of further evaluation and investigation. Remember, it might be appropriate for a lot of our audience, being the Monterey Bay, having a lot of cultural creatives that have, I'm sure, many interesting ideas of what they would like to create artistically, to check out Kickstarter, because so many artistic projects are getting funded. And a lot of them in the $2,000 to $3,000 range, too. I might add. They're not always very large. It seems like projects over 50 are less likely to get funded on Kickstarter, though that's not necessarily a hard and fast rule either. It's like the Wild West of rules in terms of what's getting funded or not. What I'm curious about is whether or not there are other groups like Kickstarter starting that and maybe have a slightly different flavor, and whether or not this will portend for the future in terms of options for creative projects. That certainly got my attention. And it also brings up another issue that you know quite a bit about, the art of failure. So many of these are successful, but many aren't. And why? Why is that? So I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the art of failure after the break, Ellie.
Excellent. Look forward to it.
Thank you. Any questions? 479-1080. Give us a call.
The art of failure.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. None of us like to fail. It never feels good. But we like to win. It's an interesting thing. But nonetheless, failing does happen, and Ellie has taught a course on it, on the art of failure. And can you tell us a little bit what you're thinking behind this, Ellie? How did this course come to be?
It's interesting. I think, Alan, as you said, it's failure is really just a natural part of life, etc. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, the way I really see the whole idea behind the art of failure was that, you know, it does make some sense to really think about entrepreneurship and starting things, you know, maybe looking at how do things fail and coming to terms with that idea. So I guess I see really the heart of the art of failure being an attitude, perspective of really inquisitiveness and exploration as you're trying to build a company, an entrepreneurial venture, and fundamentally seeing it as being a set of iterative rounds of trying things, failing at them, and, you know, continuing to go through that cycle, you know, as a process, and understanding that process of trial and error is itself the very process of creating companies.
Yeah, is it's an ongoing process. I mean, we're always looking at how to do something better, really evaluating what went wrong, so to speak. Is there a way of really evaluating basic mistakes that you shouldn't do?
I think, with this approach that we are playing with and we're evolving, the whole idea is that when you do a venture, right up front, you try to define what the key risks are, what the key questions are about this venture, and you try to bring forward these risks and these questions and go through a process of what we call fast failure, where you literally want to bring up the core questions facing your venture, mm-hmm. and you do the experimentation and you take the hit that the learning process fundamentally involves, and in the process you get through to the other end.
Mm. Now you say fast failure. You mean it's a good idea to fail fast?
The idea is it's a good idea to identify the places where you can fail, identify the areas which are the true questions that you're facing, and then go through a process of rapidly failing, given the fact that we know there's going to be failed outcomes in some of these experiments that you're going to do. Yes, the idea is let's do that process rapidly in finding the path to success.
Yeah.
That the two are really two sides of the same coin.
Well, it's a really tricky way of looking at things, because on the one hand, it's almost like if you are too gentle on yourself, then you don't aim high enough, and it's almost like you build in your own failure. Whereas if you are like the Y Combinator model, when you are just investing a little bit instead of a lot, you have a lot less to lose. And so I guess the idea is that you make a smaller initial investment, get some feedback, and if it doesn't pan out, you haven't lost as much as you would have if you had done it with a greater investment and a bigger failure.
That's really true.
I want to mention to our audience that you, Ellie, just did a workshop here in Monterey called The Art of Failure. And if you're interested more in reading this when you're not driving, please go to theartoffailure.com, and there you'll see a lot of very interesting people that spoke this last weekend, the guest speakers, there'll be videos coming up soon, the class agenda. And one of these great quotes under the pre-reading that you had given to people that came is by the Richard Farson and Ralph Keyes wrote a book called The Failure Tolerant Leader. And they quote IBM's Thomas Watson. They say the fastest way to succeed is to double your failure rate. And I think that that's the key, is that you're trying, but you're failing very quickly.
True.
I always like the saying that you can make mistakes as long as you're making new mistakes, not the same old ones over and over again.
There you go.
Now, one of the things I've noticed about your class, Ellie, is that you do have people from around the world attending. There seem to be definitely different cultural perceptions on failure and how this affects people's attitudes towards failure.
So you say it's different in China maybe than it is here?
Well, from what I remember...
Extremely different.
Yeah, from what I remember, failure is considered almost verboten. Like, it's a shameful thing to have to deal with. While in Silicon Valley, it's a badge that you have experience.
Structurally, it's interesting, Alan. You know, one of our speakers at the course is Kamran Elahian, who is a very successful venture capitalist.
Yeah, I was very impressed by him.
He has built a whole number of, you know, extremely successful semiconductor companies as an entrepreneur and now as a VC. But in any case, he was asked by the Prime Minister of Singapore to name and to be associated with an award to the most successful entrepreneur of the year. And what he said was he insisted that it be really celebrate someone who had failed and failed seriously, but who had then, like a phoenix, come back and succeeded. The reaction from his Chinese guests in Singapore was literally shock. It was like, look, when we fail, we hide it. We keep it as far away from anyone's vision. What do you mean that, you know, you want us to celebrate that and you want us to bring that up to the fore? But
yes,
insisted and prevailed.
Yeah, he was very much embraced his failures as part of his learning process. And that was very refreshing to see someone who was able to do that publicly so well. I mean,
And yet he really did a good job of telling the story of how embarrassing it was because, you know, he was a person who had been extremely successful, front page of the Wall Street Journal type successful. And so then in his second venture, when he failed, he was just as famous for his failure, if not more so, because bad news must travel 10 times faster than good news, right? And he actually had to hide out for a while he recovered.
That's really true. He did a company called Momenta, and it was the largest loss of venture capital in Silicon Valley history.
Oh. That's funny. I was researching that. It was kind of interesting because it was based on a dream, as he said, of a tablet computer, but... 1988 time frame, ahead of Steve Jobs.
Ahead of the
Before
Newton.
Before the Newton, that's right.
So how big was the failure, Ellie?
In his case, I think they lost about $50 million in about a year.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I think he told his investors that he was going to raise $100 million, and he actually, when the board met, they had actually raised $3 million. There was just no demand for the product.
Absolutely.
So what happened? Did people just didn't buy the tablet computer? I mean, was that...
It was too far ahead, I'm sure.
Too expensive? $4,000?
Well, that's really clear to him. I mean, it clearly was ahead of a lot of the technology trends. And, you know, a lot of the things that we take for granted now, things like the web, things like the internet, access to information like that, the whole wireless technologies. Remember, many of these have happened since 1988. So,
right.
Or they've become broadly available right. since 1998.
Yeah, they called it pen-based computers then. Pen-based computers. They didn't even have the language of the tablet.
But, Alan, one thing I wanted to go back to a little bit, to the whole idea of fast failure and the art of failure, is that this whole movement that I was speaking about of doing really like super low-cost, high-performance ventures, it's really backed also by a whole bunch of other approaches, methodologies, resources that have emerged that really make it possible for the entrepreneur to do it well. We mentioned Y Combinator, but there's the whole Steve Blank's customer development process, customer discovery and development process, I think is an amazing contribution.
Well, let's get into that a little bit. Now, Steve Blank was one of your earlier speakers and very inspiring, I might add. What was his customer discovery process?
He's very successful as an entrepreneur, as a venture capitalist, and also as a fellow professor, actually. He teaches at Berkeley, and he also lectures at Stanford. The customer discovery process he's developed is one that says, look, there's a lot of discipline and knowledge about how you approach the process of developing products, for example. Product development is understood. But when it comes to the process of finding customers and developing a customer base, that tends to be much more intuitive and random and not as well thought out. The customer discovery and development process, which he's working on, is one of trying to bring some direct, explicit process for doing that so that you're really putting your efforts on what really matters towards building a customer base rather than the way many entrepreneurs and many companies sort of shoot in so many directions which are not conducive towards rapid development.
Mm-hmm. They'll say they'll build the product and they will come. They won't really know how to get their customer or where they might be able to find their customer leads.
That's true.
Now, one of the other things I remember Steve said that was I thought was quite interesting was that the team that develops a product and sets up the company is often very different from the team that can run the company once the processes are in place. And that venture capital, that's often the transition point. You have the development and build team, and then you have the people that actually run the company once it's been built. I thought that was interesting.
That is really true. And I think there is an interesting point. Frankly, there are some people who are fundamentally entrepreneurs, and what they are good at is the early build phase. But when it becomes a substantial enterprise involving maybe thousands of employees, etc., that's not really where they thrive best. Obviously, some make that transition well. One thing you should understand when you take venture capital is that to some degree, especially traditional venture capital, you are giving the decision of whether you continue with your venture, even under a successful scenario, in part in the hands of others, or new board, your venture capitalists, etc.
Yeah, it's hard to turn your baby over to others sometimes. Certainly, it's a challenge to trust others when you've been working on it 24/7 for months and sometimes years on end. Now, one of the other things that you talked about here was that there's a democratization of the VC business that's going on. Now, I'm curious what you mean by that.
Fundamentally, as I've mentioned, I think the cost of launching a venture that can scale globally, particularly the cost of the early phases of understanding whether it's a customer base, the initial engagement, the development, as a result of some of these methodologies and tools, that cost has gone dramatically down so that some of these emerging players, such as Y Combinator or some of the what are called super angel groups, which make smaller investment amounts, these have really come to the fore where they're really oftentimes the backers of, I think, some of the most interesting ventures.
They take more risks.
They certainly do take more risks. I think oftentimes they also don't demand the level of control, et cetera, that a traditional VC typically would demand.
Now, I've heard of angel investors, but what's a super angel group?
A super angel is really, you know, oftentimes it's a group of angels that have banded together. Sometimes, you know, they've really brought a great deal more process and maybe staff and scale to the process of doing it. They're still relatively small funds compared to the traditional venture capital funds, but they're really a new breed of animal that's emerging.
I would imagine that each super angel group then would have their own social network for developing projects.
That's absolutely true. And it oftentimes depends on the strength of the individual partners in that super angel group, etc. And they're emerging a whole bunch of different places. But I think in addition to the super angels, what's really exciting is important. Frankly, to me, the most important development is the fact that it's increasingly possible to do ventures with tremendous potential in a very super low-cost manner.
And also the crowdsourcing of funding for projects, that seems to be on the rise too.
Absolutely.
Crowdfunding.
Crowd angels. Crowdsourcing.
Right.
In a sense, I guess Kickstarters are kind of like low-end angels in that they are funding your project, but without any expectation of return, right, in the Kickstarter model. If the rules change, then you might, or you develop some new set of rules, you might be able to have real angel funding using the net as a tool.
That's absolutely true. And I think that's going to be sooner than later.
Yeah. So do you have like a quick one sentence word of advice for new ventures that you would just encourage our audience as we close the show here, Ellie?
My feeling is really if one can have that attitude of inquisitiveness and joyful exploration and willing to take the fast failures, that's really the heart of it for me. It's a wonderful adventure, obviously.
Right. Hey, thanks for listening.
Ellie Zelka, thank you so much.
Ellie
Zelka. Dr. Future Show.
Ellie Zelka.
Thank you for your time, Ellie.
Fox News Radio.